Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining me for another Heretics Hour program, an important one in my estimation. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and today's date is February 9th, 2015. It's been a very warm day, and it's a warm evening here in South Central Texas, where I live. It was warm yesterday, and it was so warm last night that I didn't sleep very well. And now it was so warm today that I felt sleepy, and I also think there's an allergy condition going on a little bit with me, so I'm kind of tired tonight, but I'm excited about my topic, and I'm going to do the best I can in explaining to you what is on my mind about it. Now, this is kind of a continuation, in a sense, from last week's program, in which I talked about the Jewish-led European Council for Truth and Reconciliation, known as ECTR, which is a non-governmental organization that is not connected with any government or any other anything, except it just created itself, and it is the organization that has been forming this paper, these new laws they want to get passed in Europe through the European Union, called European Framework National Statute for the Promotion of Tolerance. It's all about creating a spirit of tolerance in Europe for all the different variation of peoples who ideally should be living in Europe, more and more are living in Europe, and more should live in Europe, so that Europeans learn what it is to be tolerant by having non-Europeans living amongst them and accepting their different ways and traditions and what have you. And we know who is promoting this and who's behind this, and we know what kind of a situation it's creating. But this is what is going on. And I find it extremely alarming, because I know that not only are they very serious about carrying this through to a final conclusion, but they've also carried these ideas forward so far already. So it's not like it's some pie-in-the-sky thing that isn't going to happen. I think what it is the future of Europe. And as the future of Europe, also as time goes on, the future of all what we consider white countries. So in my mind, this is, I don't see any efforts being made to stop it, except that a lot of people are not ready for it and won't go along with it. But another thing that I didn't even mention last week is that while they don't have to get through the whole thing, they are willing to have some of the points in this National Statute for Tolerance accepted by the European Union to be mandated throughout the European Union, which is now 28 states. Hopefully, we'll soon be back to 27 and maybe even less. But it's not at this particular time, it's 28. So they want the most important part of this is that it be mandatory throughout the European Union, and nobody can opt out of it. Nobody can be out of it. It's not that they have to have every last one of their points that they've created or sections that they have written with the different headings. They don't have to have every one of them. If they get a few of them, that's a good start, and then it can add to it. So this is not a something that can't happen. And as this week went on, I somewhere along the line got the idea that since it is based, all these beliefs are based on Holocaust, the progress of this kind of thinking has taken place since 1945 and has speeded up since, say, the 1970s. But it's been the goal all along. And it always goes back to Holocaust as the horrible, horrible thing that Europeans did, which is now more and more said by the Jews who are behind all this, that it's Europeans, all Europeans are guilty, is not just the Germans and not just the Nazis, because nobody would stop it. All this, which is not based on reality, but that's the way the Holocaust narrative goes. So this is the justification for why all this is necessary and why Europeans need to learn tolerance so that something like this Holocaust could never happen again, as they like to say. See where I want to start with this here. As I just said, you know, the key is, I want to put out right in the beginning here that as I was thinking about it, it occurred to me, as it does so often though, but that why Holocaust revisionism, and in this, if you want to even use the words Holocaust denialism, is so important, while many white advocates, I'm going to use the word white advocate rather than either both pro-white or white nationalists and so on. So many white advocates don't consider it so, and I have no interest in it. That always seemed to be fine, you know. That always seemed to be, well, it's all right. They don't have to be, but it occurred to me this week that, you know what? We all have to be. Everybody does have to do it, and then it would work wonders. It would really work if every white advocate got on board with it. And, of course, the most important ones are the ones who are considered leaders and have well-known, recognizable names, but it includes everyone. And I'm talking about thousands and thousands of people, European-based people. And if not just some of us, but all of us were to reject the Holocaust religion and do it openly and write about it in writing and in talking and in radio programs and so on, continually, as a regular thing, well, it would, I really do think that it would be the end of the Holocaust in, say, maybe a year's time or so. And that would be, it would be done with. Because if you get that many people exposing all the lies and the inconsistencies and the untruths, the mythologies and the craziness of this whole affair that has managed to take on this huge importance in our world, it can't stand up against it. It won't stand up against it. Who knows what the Jews would do in retaliation? But that would also be clear for everyone to see that it's they who are absolutely putting the stops on this and cutting off what would be considered free speech and so on. You know, in the United States, we still can talk about this. And if we don't, I've said before, if we don't talk about it, when we can talk about it, it's not going to be long before they say, well, they don't need to talk about it at all. And we won't be able to. And don't think that once they have laws that put you in jail for even a few words that you speak, that you're going to be willing to speak those words. You're not going to be. Just like they're afraid to speak those words in Europe today, but not everywhere and not everyone. Because it's been a lot of Germans who have the harshest laws. Germans and then Austrians, too, have the harshest laws outside of Israel. Well, I don't know what they have in Israel, but in Europe. And there's more of them who have been revisionists and have paid the price for it because they believe in it. So that's not, for the most part, once they put the lockdown everywhere, which is what this ECTR-sponsored paper law that they want to get accepted in European Parliament is all about, then that's going to be it. You know, it's going to be all over. And this is what's called, I shouldn't have to say to you, I shouldn't have to spell it out, that this is what's called full government tyranny, full tyranny of the Jews, and you know what the Jewish tyranny is like. So this is very, very important, and that's why I decided to do this show on it, even though I don't think that this idea has any chance of being successful. I don't like to say that, but I would like it to be different, and maybe I have to give it a chance. Maybe it will be. But I want to point out some of the facts that are for us and against us and so on in this idea. Now, if you think that this is a good idea and a workable idea, then drop me a line and tell me so. And if you think it's not, drop me a line and tell me that. And if you think it's not even worth talking about, then don't drop me any line. But I do wonder if this would ring a bell within people out there at all, or if it just seems to them as something unworkable. So let's start out with the fact that the Jewish power structure has a controlling hold on the United States and Europe, and even the Near East and Asia, just to some extent, and probably almost everywhere to some extent, but particularly in the white, what we call white European nations. They do, and that's a fact. And it's also a fact that every Jew defends openly and vigorously the Holocaust narrative. Everyone does. You can find a few exceptions here and there, but we're not talking about a few exceptions. We're talking about the general rule. And all the Jews will come to the surface of the Holocaust narrative when they feel it's necessary, and they and others do it all the time as a regular activity of theirs. Now, another fact is that most whites do not proclaim the falsity of the Holocaust narrative. Let's say white advocates, people who advocate for whites, do not do this. We don't do for ourselves the way the Jews do for themselves. In fact, our leaders are ones who most tellingly, do not want to talk about it and do not want to take a stand on it, and you will refuse to say that it's a myth or it's not true. And they hide behind excuses like, well, they don't really know enough about it. They haven't read about it. It's not their field. It's not my subject. I like to work with other things and so on. It's also a fact that the repetition of Holocaust trivia and its main themes is why it has come to be believed by so many people. So the fact that everybody has heard the main themes of the Holocaust, how there are Hitler wanted to kill all the Jews, and they built concentration camps and sent all the Jews to these concentration camps, and they had gas chambers and other things there, and they killed them there, and they killed 6 million. And people actually believe that because they've heard it so many times, and they've seen movies about it, and they've watched television programs about it. And so you can say, well, they're able to do that, but we're not able to do that with our material. Well, we are. We are able to do that if we wanted to do it. So this repetition is what it's not the believability of it. It's not the historical reality of it. It's not the facts of it. Even though people say, how does that go? The Holocaust is the most documented event in history. Absolutely false. As a matter of fact, there's more evidence. Okay, the majority of evidence that we have that exists refutes the Holocaust. There's far more evidence to refute the Holocaust than there is to prove the Holocaust. In fact, there's practically none. So it's a matter of illusion, lying, controlling the media, etc., and all of that. But there's nothing very little to back it up, which I'll give a few examples of in this program. There was something that I would like to, but I guess I'll wait till I get to it. I'll just follow my notes here. So another little fact is that I discovered just today that on February 6th, there was a CNN TV special called Voices of Auschwitz. It was hosted by Wolf Blitzer. Big special on CNN. I don't have TV, and so I didn't know about it until I read about it at Scrapbook Page's blog. Further Glory, who blogs there, had a big blog post about it, and I read it. Now, if I did have TV, I don't think I could have watched it. I cannot stomach watching or even listening to that stuff anymore that they put out. I can read about it to an extent, enough that I, you know, as much as I have to. I can read about it on the internet. But I don't get newspapers, and I don't follow anything mainstream like that for the most part, just except to see what they're saying, you know, what they're saying about things, what stories they've got, and so on. But I find it almost impossible to watch these things. But he watched it. He watched it, and he wrote about it. And what he tells us that was in it was that they had some survivors. Wolf Blitzer is the son of a survivor himself. That's his story, from Auschwitz, too. And this was called Voices of Auschwitz, so it's supposed to all be Auschwitz. And started out with this survivor, Ava Moses, who's Ava Moses Kaur. Now, that's her married name, but I'm just going to call her Ava Moses. She was 11 years old when she was taken to Auschwitz with her twin sister, and she tells many lies about it. You know, I listened to, she remembers all kinds of things, but of course she doesn't remember those things at all. Even if she thought she remembered them, which I think she just knows she's just making things up, but you can even think you remember things. Last week I was in my, you know, I listened to the radio in my car, and so I was driving around and I heard a radio interview with an expert who was speaking about how most people have false memories, but especially children. And it made me remember that I had just recently read a story about a man who says he was 5 years old at Auschwitz in January 1945. This is part of the whole 70th anniversary propaganda that was going on, and you know, newspapers were filled up with all these survivor stories, and this one man said this so totally impossible. He was 5 years old. He would have had to have been because of his present age. And he remembers his group being lined up to be shot. And as they were lined up to be shot, an SS man came running up shouting that the Russians were coming or the Soviets were coming or whatever. And all the guards dropped everything and ran away. And so they weren't shot after all, and they were liberated. Well, you know, I knew at the time, and I know since, it's certainly not a memory of his. As a five-year-old, person on the radio interview I was listening to, he was saying how, I'll just give this one example, that if you're talking to a child and you say to the child, do you remember when such and such thing happened last week or last month or something, whatever, and the child says, no, I don't remember that. And then you go to that same child a few days later or a week later, and you say, do you remember when that same such and such thing happened, you know, at the time that you mentioned before? And then the child will say, well, I kind of remember that. Yeah, I kind of remember it. And then if you wait a week, this is the way I remember it, and you go back to that same child and you ask that same question again, now they'll say, oh, yeah, I remember that really well, and they start describing it to you. And this is not uncommon. It's the most common thing in the world, even with adults, but mostly with children. He said it's so easy to plant memories in little children. The easiest thing in the world. And all of these survivors who are now pretty old, and they were all children when they were supposedly there, they, you know, they've been given this information all these years, and they've got all these stories that they remember this, that, and the other thing, and they you have to say that probably some of them think they do. I'm sure that some of them know they're lying, but some of them probably think that they're telling the truth. And besides this, well, I was going to go through that, but I don't, it looks like I won't have time, so. But you can read that. You can read, maybe some of you watched this or saw this CNN special, or maybe you can still, maybe I could find it on the internet, but I don't want to watch it. I can't stand that stuff. But then it went on and on, and there are a lot of errors in it. And you can read about it at Scrapbook Page's blog. He's at Further Glory at Scrapbook. Further Glory at ScrapbookPagesBlog.com, I think it is, or just Google it. But he's got it up there still as the first item, newest one. It's pretty interesting if you're into this kind of thing. But he also wrote about the day before, just the day before this show was on, there was an American television commentator called Greg Gutfield. I've never heard of him, but maybe some people have. He's half Jewish. His father was Jewish, and he's a pretty big guy on Fox News now. He's a commentator on Fox News. And in a program that really didn't have anything to do with that, he came out and said that 6 million Jews were gassed. Now, why this is interesting is that he's got the number 6 million, you know, that he's picked up, but then he said that they were all gassed, and that's not the way the Holocaust narrative goes. They weren't all gassed. They were killed in various other ways too, so that's where these people don't understand anything about it. But they pick up these little things they do have heard, and they put them together in the wrong ways often and repeat them on American television, and no doubt on other Canadian and even European television, Australian television, what have you. So the people who are promoting the Holocaust story have no scruples, and they have no honor, and they have no honesty. They do anything, and we sit there, and our people sit back and are afraid to question them on the one hand, and we're also afraid to say something about it because we might be wrong, you know. And so all these people say, well, I can't talk about the Holocaust and question it because I don't know enough about it. Well, you don't have to know that much about it. Actually, you could learn about it. And there are ways to do that without taking too much time. And you don't have to be an expert to have a few points under your belt, you know, that you can pull out, because almost everything that's said about Holocaust is not true. That's a fact. And you can certainly point out why it's not without worrying about it too much. And even if you are a little bit wrong, they're wrong all the time. They're so wrong, and they don't care. So I guess I should bring out at this point that we're in a war, and the people that I am thinking, I'm going to mention some names now, have made it clear that they take this all very seriously, this war on whites and this not allowing whites to express their white identity and to have white interests and culture and their own culture, but, you know, insisting that whites share everything they have with other identifiable people and other cultures and so on. They're very much against this. Oh, they just, you know, it's their life work to stand up against it. But can they stand up against a little bit of Holocaust stuff like this? No, the things that I just mentioned, no, that seems to be too much for them. So let me just bring out here, I'm going to start with our star person, who I have a whole lot of respect for, I'll just remind you, I've interviewed him on my radio program, or just invited him to come on a number of times in the past, and I like him a lot, and I have a huge amount of respect for him, and most people do. And that is Kevin MacDonald, who is hardly anybody says anything bad about him except the Jewish interests. And it's the Occidental Observer that he runs, and probably he started it and he manages it, but it's very popular and does good work. It says the slogan is white identity, interests, and culture. But Kevin MacDonald never writes about Holocaust unless it's just mentioning it or it's from a very distant point of view as a whole, the Holocaust culture, or what the Holocaust, what would I say, is that the way that it affects us today, the way that it affects white people, but not really getting into any specifics there. And people on the Occidental Observer also do not get into any kind of Holocaust revisionism or denialism. They do write about it in this way. I'll just use for the example something that is on there now by Francis Carr Begbie, which is about the way he always writes like this. It's about how powerful the Holocaust lobby is in Britain. He's British, and what they're up to, and how they are getting away with it, and how they're getting stronger and stronger. And this latest one was a warning about the new Holocaust Museum that's going to go up in London. This is not going to be just any little Holocaust Museum. This is going to be like comparable to what we have in Washington, D.C., the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. You know, it's huge. And this now London's going to have their own, even though they have a lot of Holocaust memorials there. And you know how big Britain is in pushing the Holocaust. They are very big in doing it. And so Begbie writes about that. People say, oh, isn't that great? Oh, that's great. Well, you know what? I liked it too, but I didn't. I thought it was a well-done article. But right away, I missed that they can't question the reality of the Holocaust. They don't question it. They accept, this article accepts it, and Kevin MacDonald accepts it. I know I don't believe he believes in it, but he's had a policy never to get into it. And while he was teaching at his university, I could understand that, but now he's retired. So just think of what it would mean if we got this wall of Holocaust denial going amongst the white advocates of that are important, and he was among them. What an impression! How powerful that would be. It would be very powerful. Of course, it's not easy. Who's saying it's easy? But if we're serious about preventing the demise of European people. And I'll just say here to make it clear that I'm expecting that's going to happen. I don't think I'll be here to see it, but I don't see that there's any framework of our own, speaking of frameworks, that is capable of stopping it. And those who are promoting it are going great guns, you know. And sure, there's a lot of people who don't like Jews now. There's a lot of people there's a lot of things going on. But they have the official organs of government and of course media and law and justice and academia, and that they have that all tied up. They do. And how do you get that? It doesn't matter if people don't like what they're doing and don't believe what they're saying. Once they get all these laws in place everywhere, and they're in charge, and they're more and more in charge everywhere, Jews are running everything, then you're not going to do anything about it. You're just not going to do anything about it. It's going to be hell for white people. And they know this, but they don't think that they take the position. I don't know what they actually think. They take the position that Holocaust is not the way to go. Based on what? Based on, is it based on a previous experience? Is it based on something you can point to and say, see, this was tried before and didn't work? No. No, it's not. Fact, it is the revisionists who have brought about so much in terms of European people's interest, and they brought about the possibility of standing up to it. Without them, without the work that they did, we couldn't be standing up to it the way we are doing today, because we would all believe what they say happened because nobody questioned it and proved that it didn't happen. But in any case, that's enough for Kevin MacDonald. I'm going next to David Duke. On DavidDuke.com, it says, for human freedom and diversity, that's the kind of the motto he has on his website, for human freedom and diversity. Doesn't even say the word white. I don't know exactly, you know, you have to guess what he means by that. He's for everybody. But David Duke doesn't want to help with Holocaust. People, they call him a Holocaust denier. It's funny, you know, so the Southern Poverty Law Center and ADL and so on, and Jews, they call him a Holocaust denier, but I don't know that he's ever denied the Holocaust, and he's kind of afraid of that now, that word, I guess, because, and then especially he's, now he says he's thinking about running for office again. What that's going to do for the white race, I don't know. I would say nothing, because, you know, he has to be very careful when he does that, and it's not going to change anything at all. But he'll be able to collect political donations, which there's lots of. You can collect a lot of money as when you're running for office. But I don't see anything good coming from that. I see worse things coming from that. But David Duke even said on national television he felt pressured to say that he believed in the Holocaust. He didn't say it very well, but he did say it. You know, he speaks up for white interests, but, you know, speaking up for white interests, the same with Kevin MacDonald, and Kevin does it really well and gets into the heart of the issues, but it's just a conversation going on between supposed intellectuals or advocates on this side against the intellectuals and advocates on the other side, whether they're just liberals or they're Jews or both. You know, it's just a conversation between these people, and it's not moving us anywhere. And it draws the people who already know all about it to read the site, and they enjoy it. It's more entertainment. And a whole lot of what we do is that people like different things. You know, some people like the Daily Stormer, some people like the Occidental Observer, but they like it because it gives them I don't want to use the word entertainment all the time, but it gives them something that's interesting to them to look at and read and look forward to more coming, you know. But it doesn't move things. It slowly can reach more people, but it's not doing what needs to be done for us to save ourselves from the demise of our race, which is coming up soon. So let's go on to, these are not people that, you know, I just took the ones that came to my mind. There's probably a whole lot of people I might speak about, and be better to speak about, that I have not, that I'm not going to mention here tonight. But I'm going on to American Renaissance. And the slogan for American Renaissance, well, the best that I saw there was a quote from Thomas Jefferson: there is not a truth existing which I fear or would wish unknown to the entire world. And that's Jared Taylor who runs that. And Jared Taylor never speaks about Holocaust and doesn't even speak hardly about Jews. But he speaks about white interests and white people and white advocacy. He does that very well, and he does it in in view of non-white peoples in mostly in the USA, but sometimes talks about Europe and probably Canada. But the thing here that I need to say is that with all three of these people and all three of these websites, I did a search for Holocaust and Holocaust revisionism, and I came up with a few things, but they weren't actually saying that they were never saying that the Holocaust didn't happen. They were never questioning the reality of the Holocaust. They were this kind of thing like the Francis Begbie and not even that good articles. And so there's just a few things that just would kind of skirt around it, or it would come up in there. That's all that was ever there. And then, of course, there's Tom Sunick, who doesn't do anything on Holocaust. And I looked at what he had on Occidental Observer, and there was nothing like that there. He says it's against the law to question it in Europe, in most places, and I'm always going around Europe, so I can't do it. Okay, Tom, fine. And then, I had to go to Countercurrents, because Greg Johnson has done some discussion of Holocaust. I don't care for that site, and I know Greg Johnson and I are not on very good terms. But, you know, when I Googled it there, or not Googled it, but when I searched for Holocaust there, of course, I came up with his essay in the past dealing with the Holocaust. And what it says about it, even on his website, it said that this article argues that Holocaust revisionism does not perform as advertised for the purpose of advancing white nationalism. So he thinks, and of course that was a big, there was a lot of attention given to that essay. It was published on the Occidental Observer, and there were almost 800 or maybe over 800 comments to it. It was... Everybody got in on it, including me. But I thought it was, you know, this is the way a lot of them, this is the way they all say, really. They don't say it this, they didn't say this sentence, but they all, this is their attitude of all these I've already mentioned, that it doesn't advance white nationalism. Holocaust revisionism does not advance white nationalism. Well, I want to say, I wrote here, I would say that white nationalism does not perform as advertised for the purpose of advancing white nationalism. Now, I do believe that. I've come to believe it, that white nationalism is not advancing the good of whites. It's no longer doing that. I don't know if I can, you know, get into that and defend that position on this program, but I'm not prepared to do that, that's what I think, all right? That's what I think. I'm disappointed with it. I'm disappointed with all white advocacy as not performing, not advancing the interests of whites in the way it needs to be done in face of the tremendous threat that's coming upon us. You know, the Holocaust... A lot of these people will all say also that they don't know enough about it, that they haven't studied, they're not experts, and they say can't talk about it. I've already said that. Well, this is what Greg Johnson thought, that he did know enough about it, and he was writing about, you know, what the Holocaust was, and that he argued that it did happen, that enough things happened, enough happened, that you couldn't deny it. And therefore, it's best to not make yourself look bad by not caring about what happened to the Jews, which he thought really did happen very badly. And therefore, it was best to just ignore it and walk around it. That was his position at the time. Well, I should have also mentioned, just a name came to me that I had left out here. Oh, yeah, I was going to say that Greg Johnson did not say that he didn't know enough about it. He thought he does know enough about it. But he got it from, he learned everything he knows not from reading revisionists or from really learning about it, but from listening to Mark Weber tell him what was what. And whatever Mark Weber told him, that's what his position, and that's what his understanding of it was then and is now, I assume. And they're friends. They were friends. And I know that, and I wrote about that and proved it, that what Greg Johnson said was directly from the paper that Mark Weber wrote when he said that Holocaust revisionism he didn't think was up to the job of whatever, fixing the world or something. He didn't think it was very important anymore, very relevant. He used the word relevant. Can't be true. It can't be true. It is not true because our enemies use it as a basis for why they do what they do all the time. So it can't be not relevant. Okay, what's this? Then also on Greg Johnson's site, he recently, very, very recently, did an interview with Majority Rights. And the people at Majority Rights are guest worker. That's a pseudonym he's used from the beginning, the man who started Majority Rights. And Daniel Sienkiewicz, Daniel S., he calls himself, Sienkiewicz, Polish name. They do the radio interviews there. And I looked to see if there was anything about Holocaust, but no, it was about Heidegger and the politics of identity. I know they stay away from that also. And actually, I happen to know, because he said so, that, well, both of these men at Majority Rights believe the Holocaust took place and have no intention of questioning it or talking about it or trying to undo it. But they think that they're so totally devoted to white advocacy and white people. And Guest Worker has been running that site for what, 15 years? And it used to be kind of a top white intellectuals discussion board, but it's gone downhill tremendously since Daniel S. took it over, was allowed to take it over, whatever. But not to get into that, but there's nothing ever been accomplished there. After all those good years that they had there and the good talk and so on, nothing, absolutely nothing. And there's no progress made on the front that they have been working on. Let me try to get this clear, that I'm saying that I don't see progress being made in white advocacy, white nationalism, on anywhere from and including Stormfront and also places like Alex Linder's forum. So because I don't see any progress, I do think that the progress can be made through Holocaust revisionism, because as I just pointed out, and I'll say it real quick once again, the basis for everything that is being done against whites really does, they always go back to Holocaust. They don't go back before that. No, they go back kind of to Jewish persecution through the ages and the pogroms and so on. But of course, they weren't bad enough to give them the power that they have today, but they led up to this Holocaust, which is huge and gets huger. It gets bigger all the time and worse, actually. Although it had a lot of crazy stuff in the beginning, but it was hard. People didn't take it too seriously. But now they've got it settled down pretty well, and really as bad as they can get these survivors to tell their stories, to where people do think it was a horrible, horrible thing, and that it affects people's resistance very much. They can't resist when they are faced with this Holocaust. So I do think that this is the best way to go. Now to continue with what I have here, okay, how about the American Freedom Party? their slogan on their website is Liberty, Sovereignty, Identity. Well, they're just about America and trying to get into some position where they have some influence. As it is, there's zero, zilch. And that's run by William Johnson. William Johnson talks about white interests and so on, but he'll never talk about Holocaust. I don't think so. I didn't even find a place to search for it on that site. Then I'll go to National Vanguard. They're doing some good radio programs now. I like them. I didn't realize, and I just started listening to them because I was looking for something that I liked. And I like Kevin Alfred Strom, who's in charge of that. And they actually have this group, they're back with the National Alliance, and they worked with William William Pierce, back in those days. Both Kevin Strom, he called himself Strom, and Will Williams, who have reignited the National Alliance from all the troubles that it was having. But they don't do much. I mean, they don't have a lot of people. They're trying to get people to join their organization is their main goal right now. And they say their goal is a change in consciousness. They wouldn't think that the way forward is through promoting the idea that the Holocaust is a myth, and I've said it this way, to dismantle the Holocaust. That's the goal. I don't think anything less than that will ever take care of our needs. And you have to believe that it can be dismantled. You have to believe that it's that vulnerable. I do. And I know a lot of what's vulnerable. And then some of the things that did happen, we have to play those things down. We can't allow ourselves to say, oh, well, you know what, that was so terrible. No, we have to be tough enough to say, in a sense, so what? You know, things like this happen a lot. And point out all the other instances in all the other countries and times when the same thing happened, and it hasn't been made of what the Jews have made into it for themselves. So this can be done. I'm quite sure. Well, I have just a little clip here, not a clip, but a little comment from someone who said that was writing about Jared Taylor, and said that about him. In response to inquiries about the Holocaust, Taylor has expressed his lack of interest in the subject. Well, I believe that, and that's par for the course with a lot of these. Now, another name I want to bring up is Stormfront and Don Black. Don Black is a good friend of David Duke, and they go way back together. He has about the same positions, and Stormfront is... I don't know if Stormfront has a policy about writing about the Holocaust, but here I have a page here from there that I was looking at, and it was pretty interesting because I was looking for some of this evidence of this lack of interest in Holocaust in our white leaders. And this was a page going back to 2008 on Stormfront. I mean, a thread, and I'm just gonna go through the first page. There's five, no, there's more than that. I don't know how many pages. There are a lot of them, but I'm just going on the first page. And the page title, the question asked is, no, it's a comment by Kevin McDonald on Holocaust revisionist discussion. Quote: "It's a blind alley. Forget about it." That's what Kevin used to say. I don't know what he'd say today, but he may not put it that bluntly, but he did think that. And so this is somebody posted this here and wanted to know, you know, what people thought about it. And this person who did said, "Should white nationalists adopt this strategy? Isn't there more to lose than to gain from revisionism? Or is it the other way around?" The next commenter said, "Telling Holocaust believers that the Holocaust was a hoax is like trying to convince Christians to be atheists. Well, he's, you know, a lot of these people aren't too smart, and I don't have much interest in what the people on forums, what they say, but I'm just telling you this, you know, how this is probably like a cross-section still of the attitudes of these people. And they're all on Stormfront, but that doesn't mean that some of them might not be Jews and fakes. So the next person said, should white nationalists adopt this strategy, that's not, it's a blind alley, forget about it. And this next person said yes, in a word. And the next one said, that was a great interview. Well, I was just talking about, because Kevin was interviewed on this when he said that. And the next one said, I like this one. Armanin said, stupidest thing by someone claiming to supposedly be against Jew power I ever heard. No wonder the Jews would be happy to promote this idea. The whole truth about them should be revealed without giving ground to them to suit their taste. The hell with them. Let all the truth come out. Or let all the truth out. So he didn't agree with Kevin McDonald. I think he's the only one on here who didn't. No, this next person says the Jews will undo themselves in time. The Muslims are the key. They are one-third of the Earth's population. Hopefully we will still be around to see it. Well, this was the kind of thing that people were thinking and saying in 2008, that, oh, the Muslims are going to take care of the Jews. Yeah, sure. You see how... Now, I will say I never fell for that. And I always said we have to do it ourselves. You can't turn it over to somebody else. But this idea that the Jews will undo themselves in time is very popular. I don't know if these people really mean it, or if they're just because they're lazy, if they're not loyal whites, or if they're just lazy people who want to think that everything takes care of itself and we don't have to worry about it. Okay, it's possible. The next person said, I respect Kevin McDonald's decision not to discuss revisionism. If he believes he can spread the truth better without discussing revisionism, then I believe him. And he goes on, it's a very long, I'm not going to read any more of it, but it's along those lines. And he says, let's look to the future. Let's not get stuck dwelling on the past. He sees Holocaust as the past. Let's analyze the past to understand the present. Let's look to the future. Well, that sounds kind of like Greg Johnson. And then we have someone, Hector somebody, who says he may have been replying to this person ahead of him. He said, that's stupid. As long as the Holocaust is discussed, it should be revised. I could see his point if no one was even talking about the Holocaust anymore. But not arguing against it today is like being pushed around by a bunch of grimy Negroes and not pushing back. Well, there you go. He's taking my position, too. And the same as the Armenian up above. So there's two on this side. There's just two more. So I will go read them. This person calls himself a Germ Brit and has a German and a British flag there. And he says, you're missing the point. Let discussions around revisionism be discussed by the revisionists. Pro-white individuals can focus on promoting pro-white ideas. We don't need any extra baggage weighing us down. It doesn't do us any justice bringing up the Holocaust. Well, that's very common. Another very common reaction and answer to this question. They think it's let the revisionists talk about it, and that's all it needs, and let the pro-white individuals focus on pro-white ideas. Well, how is that working out? Since 2008, I would say there's not been a damn bit of progress made by on Stormfront or by the people there or anything like it in this country or any country. Not one bit of progress in our situation. Now, here's the last one. He's responding to the first person's comment, should white nationalists adopt this strategy of of Kevin McDonald that Holocaust is a blind alley. Forget about it. And this one says, he is right. Kevin is right. As soon as the people hear the words Holocaust and Shoah, they think nationalism has something to do with NS and turn away. This Holocaust, World War II revisionism, is not good for us. In Germany, almost no one joins these annual Rudolf Hess memorial marches. Why is that? Because 99% of the people simply are not interested in that issue, and everything connected with Hitler and NS is seen in a bad light. And it's our people we need to have political success. Therefore, we nationalists must offer them something. A good marketing strategy that concentrates on actual issues, moderate in words, understandable, provided in words that can be verified easily, would do wonders. It's about time to throw backward rubbish overboard. Well, I thought it's enlightening and helpful to read those because it didn't take too long. And they're very much what we still hear, what we've always heard, the arguments, the feelings, and so on, very much. It's still the same today. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to play a little music for a break so I can take care of my throat a little bit. And I had decided that I would play, this one is very soft and nice, but it's this Brahms song sung by Gerhard Hüsch, and I think it's very beautiful, but it's from an operetta. At least I think I've got this right. From an operetta, and the song comes in when a couple, a German couple naturally, is getting married. They're in the ceremony, and the minister is speaking, and then they hear some music or something from up above, and they turn and look up, or maybe they turn and look over, and a man is standing there, and he's singing, and singing this song. And when the song is over, they hear him walking away, and then they smile, and they're happy and reassured or something, and they turn back and continue with their marriage ceremony. So this is 3 minutes and 15 seconds long, ladies and gentlemen. And we'll be back with the second hour of this show when this is after we listen to this.
Oh.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is hour two of the Heretics Hour on February 9th, 2015. And my subject is how to stop the Jewish takeover that is in process of making their laws, the laws of the land of our supposedly or our ancient white countries and our ancient white lands. And I think I can go forward pretty well here because I think I've got quite a bit more to say that's of value in this next half, so in this next hour. So I wanted to make it a little clearer what I have in mind or why I think this how I think this would work. It's like because it's like we have to have a solid front. Because the Jews have a very solid front. And they when they feel like they are in even the slightest little crisis or danger, they all pull together, as I'm going to show you in a minute. They all pull together. They're best people. They're biggest people. And they all start saying the same, speaking from the same playbook. And it's all over the place, and you hear it again and again and again. But we are like, instead of doing that, we're like, we're in a war. We're troops in a war, but our soldiers won't fight. Most of our soldiers and our best soldiers won't fight. They pretend that they're fighting. They pretend they're fighting, but they're not using all the weapons at their disposal. Because they don't, they're not familiar with them, or they don't want to use them, or because they're afraid of them, or any of those reasons. They want to stick with like a rifle rather than using big bazookas and missile launchers that are available. And that's what it's going to take. These little arguments that we have that everybody enjoys, these intellectual discussions and so on, they don't do anything. They don't. And if you go to the opposite extreme, or the opposite maybe side of that, and you have people just using shocking language and shocking images and making fun without very superficial, very the opposite of the intellectual arguments, very superficial arguments and articles that. I don't think that does a whole lot either, but everything does. Some people like everything, but it's not a matter of what people like. You see, it's not a matter of entertaining people. It's a matter of taking out the enemy's position. And the enemy's position is Holocaust. The Holocaust is powerful for them, and that's what has to be taken out. And we're not even trying to do it, except the revisionists are trying to do it. But they're all alone. And the others say, we don't want to work together. We don't work together like the Jews work together. Maybe we never will. If we never will, they'll win. We'll lose. But we don't seem to be in it to win. So many of our people who are on the internet and who are voices that are people and faces and so on that people know, and I'm not saying the ones that I just named either. I'm not trying to point and say all this about those men. I just use those because they're very well known, and none of them talk about Holocaust. But many people are kind of in an ego trip, or they believe what they're doing, but once they get going in it, it's like they want to kind of have them build up their turf or protect their turf or just keep their turf going, keep a certain following and keep a number of people listening to them just so that they have an identity, I suppose, or a recognition It's a self-satisfaction kind of thing, but it doesn't necessarily get us anywhere. Now, and then we have those people, and you kind of got the feeling of that in those Stormfront comments. We have those who say that Hitler caused the Holocaust, and now the white race is suffering the consequences. And so they're kind of angry, and they think we don't want to talk about Hitler or the Holocaust. They put the two together. And we have those who are like me, who say that the white race is going down because it won't follow Hitler's example and fight against the Jew and the Jewish Holocaust. Who is right? Well, of course, I think I'm right, but the Holocaust proved, this is the way the story goes, that the white Europeans don't have the moral authority to run the world. The Jews have moral authority in spite of Israel, and really they do in spite of Israel, and that white countries must bring in every kind of non-white people, I referred to this earlier, and the blacker the better, and put them in positions of authority to make sure that white Europeans won't repeat the Holocaust ever again. That is the rationale that's used. We have to do this, because otherwise, if we just want to be on our own, we'll get like Hitler was, and we'll want, this could happen again. And of course, this silly idea that never again, never again, we can't let this happen again, as though it's the most important thing in the world. And they get away with that, and a lot of people think so. That's a general belief, you know. Oh, that was the worst thing that ever happened. We can't ever let that happen again. Well, so now talking about how the Jewish power structure draws its powerful people as soon as they think they need them, and they all come out and write about, guess what? Holocaust. And, you know, on January 29th, 2 days after the January 27th, 70th anniversary, at Auschwitz-Birkenau, that was a big thing that was made out about it, and I talk about it a lot. I always like to make a big thing out of it, too, and try to use that time to bring about some truth. Charles Krauthammer, who doesn't usually write about this, did write about it, wrote something called 70 Years After Auschwitz, Anti-Semitism Surging. And this was... Well, this was carried nationally, you know, in all kinds of papers. It was doesn't say it was came from Washington, but he wrote, amid the ritual expressions of regret and the pledges of never again, on Tuesday's 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, a bitter irony was noted: anti-Semitism has returned to Europe with a vengeance. Anti-Semitism has returned a year because a few little incidents happened. It has become routine. If the kosher grocery massacre in Paris hadn't happened in conjunction with Charlie Hebdo, how much worldwide notice would it have received? As little as did the murder of a rabbi and three children in a Jewish school in Toulouse. You know how long ago that Toulouse thing was? Several years ago. But, you know, this is only the few little things that happened in Europe. But they play him up, they mention him, like this is a new wave of murdering Jews in Europe. And he goes on, as little as did the terror attack that killed four at the Jewish Museum in Brussels. So we've got the Paris thing, we've got the Toulouse thing, we've got the Brussels thing. Oh, God, oh, oy vey. The rise of European anti-Semitism is in reality just a return to the norm. For a millennium, virulent Jew hatred, persecution, expulsions, massacres was the norm in Europe until the shame of the Holocaust created a temporary anomaly wherein anti-Semitism became socially unacceptable. And he goes on and on. That's just the first three paragraphs of a pretty long article. But you see how he has no shame and doesn't hold back and just blasting Europeans and saying things that can't even be supported, but he doesn't care. And he's joined then on January 30th, the following day, by Alan Dershowitz, who's writing also, and his what he wrote here, and he wrote several things, but this one is titled Confronting European Anti-Semitism. And he writes, I just completed a 3-day visit to Prague and the former Terezín concentration camp. I was there to speak at a conference commemorating the 70th anniversary of the liberation of the Nazi death camps. Many European speakers talked about the efforts they are making to confront the rising tide of anti-Semitism throughout Europe. But before one can confront a sickness like anti-Semitism, one must first describe and diagnose the pathology. Then he says, there are several distinct but sometimes overlapping types of anti-Semitism. And he goes on like he's an expert on it. The first one, you know, the next one, and I'm not going to read all that. But he is following, you know, see, these two articles are corroborated together. No, that's not right. That's not the right word. But are connected. And now there's a couple more. January 26th, the day before, we have Steven Spielberg, warns of growing anti-Semitism at Holocaust event. Film director Steven Spielberg told a group of Holocaust survivors on Monday that Jews are again facing the perennial demons of intolerance from anti-Semites who are provoking hate crimes and trying to strip survivors of their identity. I'm not going to read any more of his, but you see how he's saying the exact same thing. And what I wanted to say earlier that I forgot was that why weren't there a lot of articles from our side denouncing these claims of anti-Semitism and Holocaust fears and so on? But there weren't. It's all taken up by... But even on their websites, you know, you say, well, we couldn't get into the newspapers. Okay. But even on their websites or anywhere, I was writing about it and trying to put down what they were doing. I did as much as I could. But I didn't see much. People just report what they're saying, but don't take out after them and denounce what they're doing and what they're saying because they're afraid to. There's no reason to be afraid anymore, I don't think. But... Now, here's the fourth one. And this was just yesterday, February 8th. It was carried by Reuters and probably other places. But this is titled, UK needs to take urgent action over anti-Semitism, lawmakers say. And you have this is by Michael Holden. But I'm going to read a little of this. He wrote, urgent action is needed to tackle a disturbing rise in anti-Semitism in Britain, including measures to deal with growing cyber hate on social media, a group of senior lawmakers said on Monday. Last week, the body which advises Britain's estimated 260,000 Jews on security reported that the number of anti-Semitic incidents in Britain had risen to a record level last year. Well, the body which advises Britain's Jews, so they're not unbiased, and they're naturally just part of a propaganda campaign here. And this group of senior lawmakers speaking is probably a group of Jewish lawmakers who are formed a group to say these things. So far we don't have more than that, but it prompted a parliamentary inquiry into anti-Semitism. Again, it's probably all the Jewish parliamentarians who are doing it. And they say that there is a palpable concern, insecurity, loneliness, and fear following the summer's rise in incidents and subsequent world events. A more sophisticated understanding of anti-Semitism is needed. And, yeah, more sophisticated understanding of anti... You need to understand the whole pathology and how sick it is and so on. And when you understand all that, then you'll... realize how we need to do something about it. And then it says, amongst their 34 recommendations, this group made 34 recommendations, there was a call for a governmental fund to pay for security at synagogues. See? And that again follows what Ronald Lauder, head of the American World Jewish Congress, who was the only non who was the only non-survivor who was able to give a speech, who gave a speech at that Auschwitz-Birkenau commemoration on the 27th, except for the president of Poland, who opened the thing. But his speech was all about this, same thing. Anti-Semitism is raging in Europe once again, and the governments need to pay to protect Jews. That's what he was talking about. Same thing. And this group also said that prosecutors should review possible action to prevent the spreading of online hate, noting that Hitler and the Holocaust were amongst the top 35 keywords used on Twitter during the summer months of 2014. So, you know, the top 35 keywords, two words out of 35, not much, but they point this out, and naturally it's Hitler and Holocaust, you see. You can't get away from it. You can never get away from it when they're deciding how to make new laws and how to get our governments to pay to protect them and do things that they want done. And they quote, I don't know, but they quote Prime Minister David Cameron saying on Monday that, no, saying that this report was hugely important. Well, that's all they have from Cameron is hugely important. So, no, here's more. He said, no disagreements over foreign policy or politics can ever be allowed to justify anti-Semitism or any other form of racism, prejudice, or extremism. But, you see, so many white writers, if they weren't afraid, who have good names, good, strong, recognizable names, could have written against this kind of thing and exposed so much of the falsity of it and the silliness of it, but also the way they twist, the way they put they do these things on their own and then attribute it to the United Kingdom and attribute it to Cameron. You know, they do this all the time. This is part of their the way they operate. And but no, you don't see anything in a serious vein. You don't see it. Now, they just wait for it all to blow over, and that's not going to work. I just thought I'd add here something by revisionist Fritz Berg, who he just sent around, because it's very good, and it's another example of what can be used against this onslaught of the Jews, but is not used except by a revisionist here and there. And even he's come up with it, but how far will it go? He found something in a book by Jacob Riss, R-I-I-S, probably a Dutch name, could be a Dutch Jew, probably, from the 1800s, about New York City's Holocaust in what was called Jewtown. And Fritz says, doesn't the following ring like something from World War II? And it's just writing about how typhus fever and smallpox are bred in New York City, in Jewtown. This is quoted from Jacob Riis' book. Filth diseases, both typhus and smallpox, are filth diseases, he says. They sprout naturally among the hordes that bring the germs with them from across the sea, and whose first instinct is to hide their sick lest the authorities carry them off to the hospital to be slaughtered, as they firmly believe. See, they believed even then that the authorities were people they couldn't trust, and if they took them to the hospital, they were just going to kill them. So they didn't want them to go, and they hid their sick people. The health officers are on constant and sharp lookout for hidden fever nests, considering that half of the ready-made clothes that are sold in the big stores, if not a good deal more than half, are made in these tenement rooms. This is not excessive caution. It has happened more than once that a child recovering from smallpox and in the most contagious stage of the disease has been found crawling among heaps of half-finished clothing that the next day would be offered for sale on the counter of a Broadway store, or that a typhus fever patient has been discovered in a room whence perhaps 100 coats had been sent home that week. each one with the wearer's death warrant, unseen and unsuspected, basted into the lining. So what this is a really good example of how these Jews help to promote, not that's not the right, but expand these diseases amongst themselves when they were, because they were in these tenement neighborhoods now, and they all stuck together, you know, and how this stuff could be spreading, and they made it difficult for the authorities to come and do anything about it. They didn't report it, for one thing. And this is very a good comparison to what went on in the camps when the Germans were trying to keep all this down and, you know, or keep them clean and in clean clothing and shave their hair and everything. It's all been twisted into stuff that, you know, that makes the Germans into monsters, when it's really the Jews who were at fault, and they were maybe not at fault for being put in the concentration camps, but they are at fault for not cooperating properly and in their own health. And this goes on to say that these neighborhoods are full of crooks too, and it was petty thieves and their allies, the fences, receivers of stolen goods, who find the dense crowds congenial. He's talking about the Jew town here in New York City. And the Bowery was the great thieves' highway. So, at this point now, I'm going to try to give an example. Let's see if I'm going to go take a look at my mailbox. Oh, my usual writer. Okay, well, I'll read this. This is from a listener about this show. He says, Gutfield is a member of the show The Five. Yes, that's what it was said. And nothing but an ignorant, lying hack. He says, our people do nothing. No, our people is the majority. The cowards and hordes, just like in Weimar. Hitler understood this, even though he could use the electoral process. So he's talking about this Gutfield that I mentioned earlier on Fox News, and the way he talks all the time. I guess he's really an anti, you know, Hitler Jew who thinks he can talk like this and gets away with it. Then the writer says, David Duke thinks change will come from appealing to a great majority, to the great majority. A tragic waste of time, knowing what he knows. It is a waste of time. It's not going to happen like that. Three-year Holocaust suggestion is not workable. You assume a mass of people opposing at the same time, when in reality it will, as always, start with the minority. They will be the lightning rod. Well, he's going to come up with his beliefs now that, of course, it's a minority. But if I'm not talking about a majority, I'm talking about our white leadership that says it wants to save the white race. That's what I'm talking about. That if they would put their attention, and if all white advocates would put their attention on the Holocaust for 1 year and really work at it, I believe we would kill it. I do believe so, because I know it doesn't take that much. I mean, that would be quite a lot, and if it was kept up. But I know I'm not going to convince people to do it, but I still say it's workable. I don't agree with the writer who says it's not workable. But anyway, thanks for writing. Now I'm going to mention how there are so many sources of things that aren't difficult to learn about, and you can take a few notes and then have a little bit of information on hand that could refute what these Holocausters are saying, or what anybody you're talking to is saying, or in an article that you're writing that you could say with confidence. And this article is written by Carl Nordling, who is a Finn, both a Swede and a Finn, lived in both countries. And he worked with revisionists some, and he wrote this article, How Many Jews Died in the German Concentration Camps? And he is an expert, because he said He says, I have spent 3 decades working professionally with the same kind of demographic complexes and processes, and therefore I regard myself as one of the few who would be competent to identify at least the grosser flaws and mistakes in a work of this kind. And the work of this kind that he's talking about is Walter Sanning's book, which is titled Well, I thought I would see it here. The number of Jews in Europe. I'll come across it here. Here it is right here. The Dissolution of East European Jewry. Walter N. Sanning was a German, and this is a pseudonym for him. He doesn't give his real name, and this was written just about in the 90s, so you can understand why. I think it was somewhere around in the 90s still, or in the 80s. But he... this book still holds up, and he did a study of Jewish populations in Europe to see whether any of these numbers that are put out, like 6 million and so on, and all the other numbers can be accurate. And this Nordling, who has also worked with the same thing, he has the highest praise for Sanning's book. And Nordling is something of an expert on it himself and has worked with it, he says, for 3 decades professionally with this kind of demographic information and processes. And he says the way that Sanning did it is he can't find anything wrong with it. And he says that he doesn't think anybody could find anything wrong with it, but probably that doesn't mean there wouldn't be something wrong with it and somebody couldn't find it. But he didn't find it. And another thing is that he used as a source a famous Holocaust historian's book that was written in the 1950s, Gerald Reitlinger's book, The Final Solution. And Reitlinger questioned the numbers that were used by the Holocaust industry and said the 6 million couldn't be right and so on. So he was a little bit more honest. In those days they were, and then they kind of pulled together and stopped being ever saying anything other than what the general narrative, the whole narrative has to be. But he says that Sanning took his information from the American Jewish Yearbook, the Encyclopedia Judaica, and the Universal Jewish Encyclopedia. He says, I have found no mistake or misconstruction of a type that would change its conclusions to any appreciable degree. Nor am I aware of any serious criticism of Sanning's results or methods in the 8 years that have elapsed since his book first appeared in German. And he says, he talks about the statistical information and how that works and so on. But he says that Sanning has used the year 1939 as one of his stop lines. And for this year, 1939, he found 5,044,000 Jews present in an area under consideration. This area was the area that the Germans controlled in 1939. So there were 5,044,000 Jews at that time. There only 2,847,000 Jews present in the German sphere of influence in June 1941. Of course, Jews will come up and say, without knowing anything, that this book is flawed, that this guy didn't know what he was doing, and they'll act like they're experts on it. But don't ever trust them, and don't ever think you have to honor what they say unless you agree with it, because these two people are quite highly qualified, and this is what they've come up with. So they talked about how the Germans did carefully register a number of the detainees at Auschwitz and Theresienstadt, which was a special Jewish town that they built in Bohemia for Jews to see how that would work out, you know. And they made it very nice, really. And Jews don't want you to know that now, but they made it very nice. And supposedly the higher class and artistic and famous Jews were sent there to live amongst themselves and have opportunities for doing their artistic work. And there's all kinds of things going on there. But it was like a ghetto because they couldn't go out. They were kept to themselves in there. And according to the Encyclopedia Judaica, 65% of Auschwitz detainees were eventually recorded as having died within the Auschwitz camp, and another 20% is supposed to have died after they were transferred to satellite camps. The number of missing detainees that they can't account for are 207,000, or 7.3% of the whole number. So I'm skipping by a whole lot of things. At some late point, this was, in April 1945, a Swedish diplomat of some kind went to negotiate with Himmler about a possible liberation of imprisoned Jews, and Himmler gave him some numbers of the Jews that were alive in a number of camps. And he thought that the sum total was fairly correct of those who were still alive. And I didn't add them all up, though, but maybe 150,000. And then also 150,000 in Auschwitz, separate from those other camps. And 200,000 Jewish survivors from all the German concentration camps. But in any case, this is what's important. The number of Jews missing in the German sphere turns out to be very far from the established figure of 6 million. Well, when they say missing, that means, that they can't account for this number of people. And they say, they can't account for 6 million people. But he's saying that this turns out to be very wrong. And, they can show that. And they have considered here only the number of Jews who died in the German concentration camps, not all the European Jews who died in the war. But you can't say that because European Jews died during the war that it was the fault of the Germans or the National Socialists. And it says among the 5,500,000 Jews in the Soviet sphere in 1941, more than 1 million died, according to Sanning's investigation. So that was in the Soviet Union. These deaths include both normal victims of the war and victims of German and Soviet persecution. So if you talk about a million Jews missing or died in the Soviet Union, they weren't all because of the Germans. There's the Soviets were causing a lot of that too. And they never want to talk about that, even though it's known. And some of them die from lots of other reasons. So, secondly, the Jewish basic population of about 2,850,000 couldn't possibly have suffered a loss of something like 6 million. This figure should have been discarded long ago. Especially since Gerald Reitlinger, who's a pro-Holocaust historian, proved it to be unrealistic nearly 40 years ago. So 40 years ago, that was already done away with, and yet they kept it. They kept it. They keep that 6 million. Of course, the number 6 million is a great way to start talking and defending Holocaust revisionism and attacking the Holocaust as a lie, because right off the bat, they've got this huge symbolic a number that's way beyond what it was or could ever be. And so that's hoaxy right there. And that's easy to talk about. So he says this Holocaust historian Reitlinger already showed that wasn't a good number. And then he says the reasonable question to ask is rather this: in view of the proclaimed anti-Semitic policy of the National Socialists and Hitler's talk about Ausrottung, which they translate as extermination, which is just really getting rid of, how could more than 2 million escape deportation? What about the famous German efficiency? So that's another conclusion he comes to. You know, Himmler had said to this Masur, this Swedish diplomat, that he had 450,000 Jews. He left 450,000 Jews in Hungary. So there was this whole Hungarian deportation is also not correct. And there were very few Romanian Jews deported to German camps. There were in Italy, France, Croatia, and Slovakia, they were only able, the Gestapo was only able to take non-naturalized Jews from these countries. But, you know, that is ones who had gone there from somewhere else to get away from somewhere. But if they were naturalized, if they were citizens of those nations, this was true in Romania, in Italy, France, Croatia, and Slovakia, they were left there. They Germans were not allowed to touch them, and they didn't. Also, naturalized Jews in Belgium, Bulgaria, and Finland were exempt from deportation. And in Poland, hundreds of thousands of Jews were allowed to stay in the city ghettos until they revolted. Most of the Jews in Denmark fled to Sweden. Now, there may be some corrections on some of this because this isn't the newest, but it's very hard. This is a area that not too many people want to work in, demographics, because it's really difficult and very, you know, you have to be a real someone who can deal with this fine little details and so on, and all these charts and records and so on. Yuck, I couldn't ever do it, but so there might be some new information if more people have worked on it. But this is pretty conclusive, well, the work that this Sanning did. So it says, we're talking, then there's just some stuff about individuals who said that they, that are said to have died. They had deported somewhere and died, but they were killed on arrival. That was it, all this stuff about killed on arrival, gas on arrival. And that didn't happen, and why. So it says the general, he sums up here, the general magnitude. You can't answer the question with any precision, he says, the question of the article, how many Jews died in the German concentration camps. But the general magnitude was certainly 500,000, but the actual number of Jews who died in the German concentration camps might well have been as low as 300,000. So the general magnitude of deaths was 500,000, not 6 million. And the actual number who died in German concentration camps could very well have been as low as 300,000. That's the figure that I give most of the time. But he says here, or as high as 600,000, just because you can't give it, you know, an exact number. And they're always erring on the side, giving more to the other side than to themselves. That's the way they do. But more, he was using control groups to compare that he had put together himself. And he had this a few sample groups of known individuals, when they were deported and where they went and where they went from there, and the whole history throughout that time, and if they died, when they died, and so on. So he compared it with what Sandy had come up with. That's the way you do this. Sandy had a big group that he didn't know any details about any of the people, but Nordling had this small group that he did know, and that's how he compared to see if it worked out right. So in the end here, he has this table, and it shows that the Jews that were present in the total population and then in the control group of his were, he gives the numbers, and they both add up to 100%. I don't know about that, but the Jews that were registered at Auschwitz and those who were deported to Auschwitz of the known group, both are, the one is 8.5% and the other is 8.6%. Even though the numbers differ, a large number on the one side and a small number on the other, but they compare. And the same, you have almost an exact comparison with those who are missing in May in 1945, a close, very, very close very close percentage of those who are known to have survived Auschwitz. And then you have an exact comparison of 5% of those who were registered at Theresienstadt. And you have a not-so-close percentage of those who were forwarded from Theresienstadt. But you have an exact comparison with those who are said to have died in Theresienstadt. And this kind of comparison that he's done here shows how good the study is. You know, shows that it's whether it's reliable or not because of how the control group, which is known, compares to the big group, which is, estimated or claimed. And then alive in concentration camps that's according to Himmler, missing, not due to emigration. So the results that come from this article, I should say here that there were also thousands of Jews that remained in Berlin when I was talking about these naturalized Jews that got to remain where they were. All the Jews hadn't been removed from Berlin. There are a lot of Jews still in Berlin at the end of the war. So what we can figure from this is what he says, and this is something you can believe in, is that 300,000, let me find those numbers again, between 300,000 and 600,000 Jews died in German concentration camps. You see? That's a lot, but it's not anything like what they claim. And maybe in the entire European war theater, in everything, maybe 500,000 Jews died. Not were gassed or not were thrown into pits and shot, but just died. Different things happened to them. Of course, the fact that you can trust, anybody can trust and say there were no gas chambers. In spite of what Mark Weber says, in spite of what David Irving wants to say, but it still has never written the book to come out or put the book out. For years now, he's been saying this and working on this book, and he still hasn't brought it out. So, but all the rest of them say and know, and you can trust it, that there were no gas chambers. So there's the number and the gas chambers are two of the pillars of Holocaust. The other one is the plan, that there was a plan that the National Socialists had a plan to kill every Jew in Europe, and they didn't, and that's also, they've never been able to come up with that. So those three pillars of the Holocaust can easily be refuted with confidence. Even if you don't know exactly yourself that that's the case, you can say that with confidence that it's been proven by the revisionists. And this is something that I think if there was a united front that was doing this, but this person that wrote in to my email about this show has already shown that most people are going to say, no, this is, can't ever work. This is no good. They don't like it, you know. They don't want to do it. Well, it's okay. I don't necessarily expect it. I don't expect they will, but I'm putting it out there because I'm kind of like this. I'm watching what's going to happen. I'm going to focus my attention from now on Call Across Revisionism and on German issues. That's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to watch all these white nationalists, not that carefully, but, you know, I like to look at quite a bit of it and follow it and see whether they are making any progress. And if any of them might decide to contact me or listen to what I have to say or take these words as valuable. And I'm going to watch nothing happening. And I'm going to watch the white race die. Die. Because it is dying. It's dying, folks. It really is dying. And people think that, oh, well, something's going to happen. Something's going to happen. Well, you know, things have died before. These Jews have got a stranglehold on everything. On everything. I already pointed that out. Every aspect of modern life. And the only way, I do believe that if they didn't have that Holocaust, and that Holocaust can be shown to be a fake, and they'll have to deal with that, and that is the only thing that will put a real crunch in them. They'll still have a lot of stuff they'll try to do, but without that, that will take them down a whole lot, and how will they justify their insistence that on tolerance and that our societies must be tolerant and can't follow any kind of National Socialist type policies. And a lot of the reason that people don't want to expose the Holocaust, and I've said this before, but I'm going to say it in a more serious light tonight because, you know, this is a serious, serious issue. They don't want to expose the truth about the Holocaust because of political reasons. And they're mostly, so many are libertarian. I would say most white people are basically libertarian, even if they deny that they're libertarian. Because they want to feel free. They like the idea of freedom, and they want to do what they think they should do on all the time. And so they want that. But libertarianism is the Jews' delight. That's what you learn in the protocols, too. And there's a lot to be said about those protocols. So, ladies and gentlemen, that's my program for tonight. You've been listening to me, Carolyn Yeager, on the Heretics Hour on February 9th, 2015. I want to thank you very much for listening, and I will be back with you again next week. For now, good night.